from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. Welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency.
Hello and welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Travis DiNicola. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Walrab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
And I'm Sharon Gamble. Today is the 10th anniversary of The Art of the Matter, and to celebrate, we have a special segment with Travis, Matt Sosi, and me sharing our favorite moments from those 10 years.
I'm looking forward to that, and we'll also have some regular interviews as well. I'll start off the show with the Indiana Author Award winner, and then later on I'll chat with curator Chris West about his new gallery.
And I get to chat with Cole Porter, well, at least an actor playing him. All this and more right after the latest news from NPR. The Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award is looking for the next generation of great Indiana authors. James Alexander Thom is the winner of the National Author category for the inaugural award. Travis DiNicola spoke with Thom and with Emily Berger from the Library Foundation.
Congratulations to you, James Alexander Thom, for being the winner of the first Indiana Authors Award. That's quite a great honor.
It feels like it to me. I'm very happy.
Well, I am delighted to have the opportunity to talk with you today about your work. We're first going to start, though, by finding a little bit more out about the Indiana Authors Award and all the awards that are part of this this first year, this great celebration through the Library and Library Foundation. Emily, tell me about how this all came to be.
Sure. Well, this was actually kind of a glimmer in the eye of Mr. Eugene Glick several years ago. And over the course of the last few years, the Library Foundation has been working with the Glick Fund, a fund of the Central Indiana Community Foundation, to fund this inaugural Indiana Authors Award. And we look forward to many years of the award in the future. It's a way to honor and recognize Indiana's literary tradition, and we're really hoping to bring to light all of the great literary talent that's both from Indiana and in Indiana by recognizing them with these awards.
And the awards are not limited to one category or even to people who live in Indiana now.
That's correct, actually. Eligible authors included anyone who was born in Indiana or who has lived in Indiana for 5 years. So several of our honorees this year actually live out of state but were born or raised here in Indiana, and so kind of had that Hoosier upbringing in their background. We have three award categories, national, of which Mr. Thom is our national author winner, and then we have our regional and emerging categories as well. Regional category comprised of anyone who has kind of familiarity across the state. And then our emerging authors are folks who have only published one book. And so we're kind of hoping that this will be a catalyst for them to publish future titles.
That's great. Now, how did people get nominated? This was quite an extensive process.
It was. We opened up the nomination process in late February and closed it in April, and it was a public nomination process. So authors could self-nominate, publishers could nominate, but we really saw that the majority of our nominations came from fans of these authors who wanted them to receive this great recognition for their work.
That's great. And there obviously must have been quite a number of nominations for James Alexander Thom.
We definitely did, yes. Mr. Thom received a real upswell of support from people here in Indiana, but we had nominations from all over the country as well.
Mr. Thom, again, congratulations. This is a great honor. I know that this you've written a number of things. You've been a reporter. I know you wrote for National Geographic, have done a number of nonfiction books. But primarily, I believe that this award is honoring your historical fiction.
Yes, I think that's almost funny because historical fiction does not have a real great reputation. People think of the bodice rippers, you know, and all that kind of thing. But what I've tried to do, and I hope people in this field will start doing, is they will work as adjuncts with real historians and write stuff that is dependable in its historical research and presentation. So
there's quite a lot of responsibility that goes with historical fiction, I would imagine.
I think there is, because Now, my books, for example, are used as supplemental reading in history courses, both in high school and college.
Mm-hmm.
And so if anybody's going to be picking up some history while they're reading a story, I think it should be accurate history.
And your books are primarily dealing with the frontier, the Indian Wars. Tecumseh, I know, is one of the works that you've done. Tell me a bit about your interest in that period of history and that subject matter.
I got started in historical novels. I didn't intend to be in that business, but back in the United States Bicentennial,
mm-hmm.
The Indiana Historical Society was honoring George Rogers Clark. And somebody there suggested that I might write a dramatization of his life, a novel or something, a play or something. And so I got started on that, and as I worked on it, I kept running into these other little stories that eventually became a spinoffs almost, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so without ever intending to, I ended up writing in the past, and it sort of became my profession. The farthest forward I've gotten so far is I did do a book on the Mexican War, which took place in the 1840s. That was St. Patrick's Battalion, came out last year. And I'm working on one now that's a Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm pretty soon I'll catch up with myself.
Well, you're practically writing about just yesterday as you
yeah.
move forward on this. Would you share with us a bit of your process in terms of how you go about your research? Is there travel involved? Lots of days in dusty libraries, archives, things of that nature?
Yes, there is. I have not learned how to research online, and I wouldn't depend on that a whole lot anyway, because so much of the material in there just keeps getting fact and fiction churned back in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but it's, my old way was usually to start at the Library of Congress, because that's where you find out where it is or it can be found.
Mm-hmm.
The Indiana University Library at Bloomington has about 80 or 90% of everything I ever need. But a part of the research for me, the greatest thing is to go out where the things happened.
Yes.
And to sit at a desk and try to imagine the Battle of Gettysburg, you know, that's no good. And so I get involved not just in going to the places, but I also get involved in researching, for example, what grew there then, what was the population, what was the political philosophy of the time, and then I also spent a lot of time learning how to use the tools and the weapons that they used in those times too, so that I can, if I'm writing about a battle where they're all using muzzle loaders, for example, there's a great deal of sensuous description to be done there, including
sure.
the smell and the noise and the and the effort, you know, and the difficulty of breathing and all the smoke and all that sort of thing. So getting involved in the physical reenactment of something is an awfully important part of it, because what I need to do is put my reader there. The reader is going to be right in the middle of the scene instead of pointing back and saying something happened 200 years ago. I take the reader back and say, this is happening now, and you're in it.
I would imagine even things such as food or clothing mm-hmm. become a very big part of that sensual experience that you're conveying.
Absolutely. We live in a world that's totally different from what I'm writing about, and consider the fact that there was no refrigeration in those days. People went out into the battlefield. They had to either lead herds of cattle, or they had to depend on game, or even worse, they had to depend on pickled meat that was provided to them by government contractors, and usually it was rotten, you know.
So
to describe some of that stuff is really pretty disgusting. Especially, and I found myself time and again having to write about smallpox epidemics and epidemics of illness and starvation and so forth. And to describe medical things is a real challenge. And it can be pretty disgusting.
Well, on a different note, let me ask you, have you had the opportunity, as you're comparing different sources, different texts, doing your own research, to make any historical discoveries yourself as you start connecting the dots?
I don't know whether I've actually made any discoveries or not, but what I have done is I've sometimes arrived at different conclusions from what the historians hold to be the prevailing wisdom. And sometimes they will say, well, he's just a novelist, you know, what does he know? But
imagination thing. Yeah. Gets out of control.
Several of my historical novelist friends have actually disproven things that historians had just accepted for a while. I don't know whether I've ever done that or not, but I've tried to correct some of their misconceptions. See, a historian strives for objectivity, but a historian, if he writes a book, he's got an axe to grind, or he has a certain way he believes it happened, and some of them have a tendency to aggrandize the point of view that they have, and to the point that is not really quite realistic. And you would usually think it's the fiction writer that does that, and the historian's
not
calming
down. But you're actually not encumbered by trying to prove a point, in a sense, because you're telling the story.
No, but I, too, have an axe to grind. You know, here's what happens. I will get inspired to tell a story simply because it inspired me, you know. And then as I work on it, I find out truths that I really didn't even know were there. And they become a coloration for the story.
Well, I am greatly looking forward to reading your books. I'm sorry that I have not, and I'm very intrigued about reading them. I know Panthers in the Sky, Follow the River, From Sea to Shining Sea, excuse me, are some of your works. Emily, I want to turn the conversation back to you as we wrap this up, because I know there's a number of public events surrounding the Indiana authors. Of course, James Alexander Thom has already been announced as a national author winner, but you mentioned there's the regional author and emerging authors. Those will be announced at a big event on Saturday, the 26th.
That's correct. We have, in addition to an award dinner that evening on the 26th, where we will announce our regional and emerging winners from the three finalists that we've named so far, we have a full day of free public programming at Central Library in downtown Indianapolis from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. That includes some workshops with the Writer Center on how to get published, book sales and signings with over 50 local authors from Indiana. And of those, Mr. Thom will be one, as well as our finalists in all three categories. So we have Margaret McMullen, Scott Russell Sanders, Jared Carter, James H. Madison, Susan Neville, Kathleen Hughes, Christine Montross, and Greg Schwipps, just to name a few. And we're excited to welcome all of them to Indianapolis for this very special event.
Excellent.
And recognize their talent.
And if you're listening to The Art of the Matter on Friday evening, that is tomorrow from 10 until 4. If you're listening on Saturday, I'm sorry that you missed it, but there's still a lot of great books you can pick up at the library and enjoy the Indiana authors.
Travis DiNicola with the winner of the Eugene and Marilyn Glick Indiana Authors Award National Author winner, James Alexander Thom, and with Emily Berger from the Library Foundation. The award ceremony for the awards takes place on the evening of Saturday, September 26th. For more information about the awards, visit IndianaAuthorsAward.org, IndianaAuthorsAward.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on WFYI 90.1 FM Public Radio.
He was urbane, sophisticated, extraordinarily talented, and he hailed from Peru, Indiana. He was Cole Porter, one of the Native Son stars in the firmament of the Great American Songbook. Cole Porter will be celebrated on Saturday, October 3rd, by actor Rob Johansson and Encore Vocal Arts and their conductor, Chris Ludva. Sharon Gamble invited Rob and Encore Vocal Arts board member Donna Barmichael into our studios to learn more.
I'll remember forever when I was but 3, Mama, who was clever, saying to me, "Be a clown, be a clown. All the world loves a clown."
Fabulous, isn't it?
Rob Johansson, folks, channeling Cole Porter, channeling popular lyrics of the time.
Right.
Is that an
sure.
apt?
That's right, that's right.
The world does love a clown. The world loves an entertainer as well. Donna, how did, or Rob, I gather that this particular partnership, this particular idea of this particular concert started on something of a whim and has been developed ever since. How did this get going?
It's one of our artistic director's famous collaborations.
Uh-huh.
He gets an idea in his brain and it germs and it starts to grow. And Chris Ludva, our artistic director, has started all of this. But who can go wrong with Cole Porter for music, mm-hmm. for a concert? And then we have the fabulous Rob, who is just going to make a wonderful additional show collaboration with us by portraying Cole Porter, and showing us the personal side of him in the concert, and that will give us that kind of intimate quality that is typical of a radio hour.
Folks who've seen Rob on stage in theater productions will not be at all surprised that he's a researcher. You do your homework. You find out all about a character before you portray him. So for people who know Cole Porter is a Native Son but maybe don't remember much else about him, can you give us a little sketch of who was Cole Porter and how did he get to be so fabulous and so famous?
You know, I've been looking at the arc of his life, and I'm always fascinated to look at a performer. You know, one thing that comes off the top of my head, you'd be surprised how much he got panned.
Really?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Most people look at Cole Porter's body of work now that it's complete, and you think, well, he's an icon. You know,
absolutely.
And you couldn't imagine somebody like him ever getting a bad review.
Yeah.
His first Broadway show was See America First, and it got killed.
Are there any tunes that survived?
From that show? Yeah. Well, they survived, but, you know.
They aren't in the greatest
hits. The scholars would, I think, know about them. Now, I have to go back and look. I don't think there are any mainstream Cole Porter songs that survived from that show. But it closed 2 weeks.
Ouch.
And the funny thing is, though, it launched Cole off to Europe. Cole went to Paris after that.
This was in the 20s?
Earlier.
Earlier.
Cole, when he went to Paris, I think, you know, the things that happened to him there really launched him into the career that everybody knows about.
So that rejection might have been good.
Yeah, it is kind of nice from a performer standpoint. You look at somebody's life and you go, wow, you know, he had some amazingly dark places,
mm-hmm.
and oftentimes came out of them. You know, I'm fascinated by the fact that Cole Porter was very lucky because his grandfather was very wealthy. Then his wife was very wealthy as the result of a divorce.
Mm-hmm.
His wife divorced a man who was cheating on her. And she basically, before 1920, came into $1 million.
I don't even know what that is in adjusted dollars, but it's substantive amount.
Yeah. So basically, long story short, Cole Porter had a lot of advantages in that he didn't have to hold a 9-to-5-er.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I like, though, is he took advantage of the time that he had, of the world that was given to him, and he worked hard. He practiced 6 hours a day at his piano. He also did a lot of other things. There's more than 6 hours in a day. But he filled every moment, we'll just say. And we do talk about some of that in the show, because I wanted to look at not just his performing, but some of his off stage, away from the piano,
sure,
antics as well.
Antics. People can't resist making films about this man. And from the three or four film versions of his life I've seen, I kind of get the impression, tell me if this is the impression you two have also gotten as you've read more about him and prepared for this concert, that Peru, Indiana, while it's a lovely place to be from, I went there for the first time a few months ago. I'm embarrassed to admit that I've lived in Indiana for 30 years and had never been to Peru. It's lovely, but, oh, it is a small town. And I got the impression he kind of just said, okay, the door's closing behind me. I am a citizen of the world now.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that sounds exactly like him. He was so, and perhaps this came naturally to him, or perhaps it came as he traveled, but he was so suave and sophisticated. And where do you get that understanding of language and that witty repartee and, you know, all of that? How does that come about from a smaller, more rural environment? Or did it come when he went to Paris? Rob's going to answer some of those questions,
sure,
for us.
You know, I think that initially he had a passion, even when he was in Peru. And the research that I've done shows that he was really taken by circus performers.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the first things I'm going to talk about in the show, is the, and that's why I read the Be a Clown reference. He was blown away by how hard they practiced,
mm-hmm,
and also the fact that the crowd loved them. And I think that was the spark that allowed him the inertia to want to go on and on and on. Some things that aren't in the show. He studied piano as a kid, and he says that piano playing ruined his childhood.
I think a lot of people would say that.
Yeah.
If you have children who are taking piano lessons, turn the radio off right now.
But, well, kids, though, if you're listening, think about this guy. Do some research about Cole Porter and find out what a wonderful life he had.
Absolutely.
Because of his
there
piano
you go.
Playing.
Absolutely.
He also attributes the work ethic that he developed through piano playing as one of the reasons he was able to get into Yale.
Really?
Yeah. So, you know, good things came of it, but he loved to joke that, you know, oh, all I did as a kid was play piano. And one of the first times he actually performed, he would sneak on to a boat, one of these summer lake boats, like a gambling boat, a steamer, you know, that would go around in the Peru area. I'm trying to remember what lake that might be, but he would sneak on, and there was a piano, and he would sit down at the piano and start banging out tunes. And people used to say he was not the best piano player, but he had this chutzpah, this magnetism. And the captain of the ship used to get so angry because all of a sudden this kid was playing the piano and he was soaking wet from having swum on the boat, and he was going to ruin the piano because he was wet. But the really cool thing about it was Cole developed his sense of rhythm. He couldn't get the rhythm right on the piano, and one night he listened to the engine on the boat and the rhythm it was laying down. And he matched his piano playing to the engine. And a lot of people say that his songs throughout his career kind of matched that steam engine.
Wow.
So it's kind of cool.
That is so cool.
That's really
now you are going to sing a little bit, because you do sing, but most of the singing will be the ensemble.
We'll leave that
to the professionals.
Right. Those 40 auditioned folk.
There you go. And the conceit of the performance is this is the Cole Porter Radio Hour.
Correct.
Is there any audience participation possibility here? other than being good listeners.
And good laughers.
There you
and
go.
Applauders.
And who knows, maybe somebody will get up and start dancing just like they would at home if they would have been listening to the radio.
Absolutely.
I mean, you can dance to this music like crazy.
And I think as far as audience participation, I am planning, the way that I'm attacking this is that I'm going to be talking to the audience as if I'm...
They're guests.
Yeah, yes. And I'm looking back on things in Cole's life.
Actor Rob Johansson, Cole Porter, and Encore Vocal Arts board member Donna Barr Michael with Sharon Gamble. You can hear the concert, the Cole Porter Radio Hour, at 8 p.m. on Saturday, October 3rd, at the Caleb Mills Auditorium at Shortridge High School, 3401 North Meridian Street. You can also go to EncoreVocalArts.org for more information. Again, EncoreVocalArts.org or call 576-7676. Sharon, congratulations on 10 years of Art of the Matter.
Woohoo! Where's the cake?
Well, we're about to have some with Matt Sosie, and we've got a special segment coming on. But I wanted to actually let listeners know that we're not going to do our regular calendar that we call
What'll We Do
this week
because
of our special segment.
Because we're talking about what we've done for the last 10 years.
Exactly. Well, sort of a What'll We Done?
It's a What Have We Done? We do have a quick clarification, though.
That's right. I just wanted to let people know that the President Harrison Home is offering free admission on the Smithsonian Magazine's 5th Annual Museum Day, which is on Saturday, September 26th. But to do that, you do need to either be a member of the Smithsonian, or you can go to smithsonian.com, and then on Museum Day, you can download your Museum Day admission card so that you can get in free, because you do need to present that card.
Excellent.
Great, and we'll be back next week with more of
What'll We Do? Of Art of the Matter memories. We are Sharon Gamble,
Travis DiNicola,
and I'm Matthew Sosie.
I feel as though we're doing our holiday program now.
I know.
Usually,
well,
the time we're together.
It is Christmas.
Since I've celebrated
it's cold
10
in the
years.
Studio.
Yeah.
The weather outside is, well, not frightful
I'm
yet.
I'm sure you've celebrated 10 years of something at some point.
Well, this is actually a pretty big milestone.
It is. It's I had Dick Wolfsey as a guest on a few months ago. And in his most recent book, Mornings with Barney, it's the story of his life with Barney the Beagle, who...
made more money than all three of
made
us.
Made more money than, well, made more money than Dick Wolfsey, if you believe the book. But it's also kind of a journal of a life in broadcasting. And Dick Wolfsey makes a point of saying that 2 or 3 years is a really long run for a television or a radio program.
Yeah.
Yes.
So we're three times that and counting.
Well, I know that we all want to talk about sort of, you know, some favorite moments and things that have occurred over the years. But Sharon, you've actually been here the longest. I mean, Matt and I came in 2001.
Correct.
And
you're the historian.
Would you?
But not historical.
Start us off?
Not historical.
But just tell us a bit about, you know, how it all started.
Well, actually, back in WFYI Radio, even back when it was called WIAN Radio, has a long, long history of talk programs about all sorts of things, including religion, including Latino and Hispanic culture, and including probably the most common topic of talk programs over the years for this dial position is the arts. And in the 90s, there were a couple of successive programs. One was called Indianapolis Weekend, followed by Standing Room Only. And then there was a period in the mid to late 90s when there weren't any arts talk programs on this particular station, and some folks got together and said, let's change that. We want local arts talk programming back on again, because there's such a rich cultural landscape here. So I'd have to get it out to tell you what the literal mission statement of the program is, and we did craft a mission statement back in 1999, but, you know, if you listen to the program, you know what it is.
And
it's
this
to talk
was you
about arts and culture.
And Lynn Stafford and
Lynn
Stephen
Stafford and
on.
Jed Duvall. And Lloyd Wright had a hand in the creation of the program. And it started on September 25th, 1999. It was a Saturday afternoon. And the program has always had, since its beginning, the time slot of 4 to 5 on Saturday afternoon. And as you know, we recently added 8 to 9 on Friday night as well. So we were doing a little math amongst us the other day. Let's see, 3 to 4 interviews a week, about 51 weeks a year, because we sure. always break format for our holiday program and play music times 10 years, and we still haven't talked to everybody.
Yeah.
We got a long way to go, but we're having fun.
1,500 interviews.
I know.
I mean, that's, you know, well, even though it did feel a couple weeks ago when we were live at Penrod, like we did
1,500
interviews in one day. You know,
are you sure we didn't?
So, yeah, I know. I mean, 1,500 interviews, and it's like, you know, how do you even pick, you know, ones that were, you know, favorites or stand out? I mean, there's been, you know, so many great people we've had a chance to talk with over the years. But, Matt, I know you've got some.
I guess I'm technically second in seniority. I started at the station in May of 99, and in 2001, after Lynn had left, Jed Duvall at the time decided to, I called it the Regis thing, that he was trying out different co-hosts with Sharon, and in February of 2001.
Oh, does that make me Kathy Lee Gifford? Oh, please, no.
No.
Oh, thank you.
No, far from it. So in February 2001, I sat in on a session of the show, and then a few weeks later, I was approached by Jed and by Sharon and saying, why don't you fill the slot until we figure out what we're going to do. And that turned into a summer.
What do we do?
What do we do? Thank you.
Wait, one, two, three.
What do we do? In 40 minutes time of the hour. So anyway, I did it for the summer, and then it went into the fall, and then came Travis.
Yep, and it was that fall, Jed, you know, the same thing, gave me a call and said, hey, why don't you give this a try? We're looking to, you know, fill in some different voices and different perspectives, and you want to join Sharon and Matt? I said, sure. You know, did they come apart?
Where's that jazz fest percussionist when I need him?
We'll get them.
Okay.
And then it became alternating. You would do it, and I would do it. And not since the Phillies and Mets have there been such a neck-on-neck race.
It was a complicated schedule.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Phillies and Mets from a few years ago. But
you know what? We should explain. Lynn Stephen Stafford did not drop off the edge of the earth.
No,
he actually moved to Detroit. He has
a... Insert favorite Detroit punchline here.
He's back, by the way, in Indy. So. He moved to Detroit to take a job in advertising with a division, with essentially an agency that serves General Motors. Did that for a few years and moved back kind of recently.
What happened next was Richard Miles became our new our new boss, and he finally decided that that Travis would become the permanent.
Well, and you would, and this was at the same time you were basically taking over the Blues show,
right?
And doing that, and also then adding in your movie show.
Right, I did the Blues House Party, and and you guys, and of course Mike Fenwick, our beloved producer, still wanted me involved in some capacity. So
absolutely.
I was doing Matt at the Movies.
Who would we make fun of without you?
That's right.
Sorry.
So let me adjust my court jester hat and bells on my feet. But I started doing Matt at the Movies and occasionally doing interview segments. And Matt at the Movies evolved into film sociology, which you can hear Fridays at 5 on WFYI, HD2,
The Point,
and WFYI.org.
Yay.
But, so, yeah, it's still fun, and I appreciate you guys for letting me still be a part of this whenever possible.
Oh, it's a tradition.
Sharon, what about you? What's a good memorable interview? I know it's so hard to say, you know, favorite or worst.
Let's not go there. You know, I've been looking through past calendars at many of the interviews, and it really is hard to choose a favorite. It kind of depends on the topic and sometimes the chemistry. And, you know, I guess my favorite is the one I'm about to record in some ways, because so exciting to get people in here and you know, chime in with some stories here, because, as we know, some people are lots more comfortable behind a microphone than others, and some people come in and they're just petrified.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to figure out a way to get them past that.
What's
your most dangerous interview memory, Travis?
I have two fiascos.
Oh, no.
That I was thinking about. And both of them were with famous people. One was with Garrison Keillor.
Mm-hmm.
One was with Meryl Streep. So you tell me which is the worst fiasco here. The first time I interviewed Keillor, and thankfully I had a second chance to interview Keillor in person years later, which went much better. But the first time was by a phone line, and we're actually an ISDN line, which is like a phone line, but it's supposed to sound better.
Mm-hmm.
We were at the old studio, and they kept on having enormous problems getting it to work. They couldn't get it to work, and Keillor was waiting, and he was doing a whole big tour of supposedly talking about, this is when the Prairie Home Companion movie came out.
Right.
Yeah.
And so he's waiting, waiting, and they probably had him waiting for 15 minutes, and he was getting annoyed. We finally get the line going, and so I ask him about the movie, and he's like, I don't want to talk about the movie.
Oh.
I'm like, oh, well, then, you know, sort of like, what are we here to talk about?
What's the point of the publicity tour?
And right at that point, the door opens up, and the janitor comes in, and we're seeing, and he's talking really loudly and starts yelling at me because we forgot in going back and forth with trying to get the ISDN light on to turn the on-air light on. So he's yelling at me, telling me that the on-air light isn't on and I should have it on. And Keeler basically just sort of started laughing and basically said, like, why am I even talking to you? So that was not a great moment.
He didn't fire you?
No, no. So like I said, it was great to be able to redeem myself years later when I got to interview him again in
person. You
should have
just started making sound effects.
It was so painful. It was really painful. But,
oh, I feel for
but
you.
I actually think that when I got a chance to talk to Meryl Streep, she was in town for Don Gummer, who is her husband. He is a big
sculptor.
He's a sculptor,
yeah.
And he had a big public sculpture unveiled on the south side of downtown.
Sure.
And I was down there, and it was my first on-location interview. I just got my new equipment to, you know, go on location, and I was still trying to figure it out, and all the press stuff beforehand had been very clear that she did not want to talk about her career,
right.
Did not want to talk about her movies, but she would be happy to talk about her husband's artwork.
And her husband's from here.
Her husband's from here and went to Heron. And so it had been arranged for me to meet her and interview her, and so I go up to her, and as I go up to her, and she's very short, by the way, I mean...
No, she's not.
She's standing on boxes in Julie and
Julia. She's really not that tall.
Yes. Okay.
So as I go up to her, I trip. And as I trip,
no,
I was afraid that I was going to drop my new recording equipment. And so I tried to grab for that, and I got tangled in the headphone wire, tripped even further, ended up basically landing on her with my two hands on her chest, as you can imagine. And after we recovered, she looked at me and she said, are you the guy from public radio?
Wow.
So,
public radio,
I don't know, you know, as bad as the Keeler experience was, I think the Meryl Streep
was. You got a second shot with Harris.
But she at least laughed.
She did laugh, and
okay.
She was so sweet. And
very
she actually,
kind.
She took me over and introduced me to her husband and said, you know, and she said, Don, please talk to Travis. You know, he's from public radio. We like public radio.
Wow, he didn't beat you up.
Yeah. So those were probably the two most horrendous moments I've had. But
Sharon.
And while we might have heard the interviews, I don't think we've heard the stories behind them.
And so many people actually think we're live, and we are.
They do.
You know, live at things like Penrod, but actually most of the time we record our interviews ahead of time, usually the week that we air it. And
great compliment.
We'll often get together, you know, on Monday evenings to record all the other
mm-hmm.
stuff, the
mm-hmm.
behind-the-scenes stuff. And people always wonder, when did you guys do that?
Yeah, it's magic. You referenced Penrod a little earlier, a couple of weeks ago. I'm not going to name names because this is a very dear person, but I asked him a question about something that was coming up in an event mm-hmm. that he and some others were sponsoring, and he said, well, I think somebody else, this other person, would be the better person to answer that. And I looked around and I thought, well, that other person isn't here. You're the one who's here. So the cool thing about live radio is you have to think fast and think, how do mm-hmm. I move on from this? Next topic, please.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you're both looking at me.
We are. Mm-hmm. I'm expecting you to tell the story about a pre-recorded interview.
All right, I will.
Please, please. It's a classic.
Oh, geez, the F interview, I guess it's now called. Mm-hmm. I was interviewing an actor in town, mm-hmm. a wonderful gentleman, who we had on since. And we were recording the interview, and I had asked about a casting question, and it was something that had not officially happened yet. So, being a...
Because you're recording it before it airs.
Right.
And they couldn't announce it.
So, okay. So being a person, that we have a great producer, he'll edit this section out. So I used a certain word that we know you're not supposed to air because mm-hmm. he'll edit that out. And said guest also did the same, followed suit. Well, the piece was saved, the piece was edited, and
mostly.
And due to a technical snafu involving lightning hitting the building or something along those lines, force majeure.
Sometimes those things
somehow
creep back in.
Yeah, somehow the original unedited recording aired.
Mm-hmm.
I was in a car. I almost drove into a ditch.
So did Mike Fenwick, our then producer.
And so, yes.
Yeah. Because that word happened not just once, but like three or four times?
Yes. And what was
It's funny now.
Oh,
there,
yeah.
There was a
oh,
period
it's
of,
it was horrifying
there was,
at the
there
time.
Was a period of about 3 days I thought my radio career was really over. And fortunately, things had smoothed out. Everything was all right. And then about 6 months later was the infamous Janet Jackson thing at the Super Bowl, to which...
wardrobe malfunction.
To which then Jed Duvall... And then because everybody started to get really touchy about things that were said.
Well,
and,
see, it was better that happened after.
And Bono said something during an award show, and I was informed by Jed Duvall at the time. He goes, if that had happened now, you would be fired. So,
wow.
Said actor came back in. We did a tribute to the playwright August Wilson
who had passed.
And... We had him and another gentleman on the show, and we were talking about Wilson's work. And I remember Mike Fenwick said to said guest, now watch your mouth.
So I do want to mention that we have been instrumental in a marriage. Well, possibly more than one marriage. We might have caused fights.
That's
I don't
right.
know.
That's,
I
a, nice,
hope
that's
that.
A nice note to end this on.
Speaking of female writers from Indiana, Kathy Day from Peru, Indiana. Travis interviewed her once. I interviewed her once. And then we interviewed her together about her book, The Comeback Season, which paralleled her hope and search for true love with the Colts' comeback season. And someone Kathy had known when she was...
But the Colts season ended with a Super Bowl win. Kathy's book ended with her still being single.
It did indeed. But because of the art of the matter, she got her own comeback season. A gentleman she had known, and they'd kind of had a little bit of a crush on one another, I get the impression, when they were both interns fresh out of college in New York City 20 years before, was... living in Indiana now, was driving to the grocery store, heard her voice, heard the interview, Googled her, tracked her down. He was living here. She was living in Pittsburgh. And as they say, the rest is history. They got married a little bit earlier this year.
Yeah. Isn't that cool?
And it's, you see, so during the pledge drive, when we say support your NPR news source and the source of the art of the matter, it might be responsible for a true love coming into your life.
I thought you were going to say, any single artist, please send your profiles to...
to me. I'm the only one in this room who's single. Thank you very much.
The eHarmony of WFYI, is that...
Well, let's do it all together because we're not
going away. It's not a eulogy.
No. And as we said earlier, we're not having a calendar this week, but we will be back next week with our calendar that we all call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202. Or you can email us at artofthematter@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
Contemporary art curator Chris West has a new gallery called Chris West Presents, which is located in the Dean Johnson Gallery on Mass Ave. His first show features the work of Heron painting professor Danielle Felice Reedy. Travis DiNicola spoke with Chris and Danielle about the show.
Chris, I want to just start with you. Congratulations on your new gallery, Chris West Presents. How cool.
I'm very excited. Very excited.
I'm sure you are. This is a great opportunity for you. Most recently, you were the curator at iMOCA, and now you've got a space that's part of the Dean Johnson Gallery on Mass Avenue.
Correct.
Tell me just briefly about that, and then I want to talk to Danielle about the opening show at Chris West Presents.
Well, Scott Johnson of Dean Johnson Gallery and Dean Johnson Design and I were brainstorming one night. His gallery director had just left. And we were looking at different ways, either hiring me like part-time to just kind of take over those duties or to try to do something kind of unique. So what we've done is we've basically taken the gallery as it existed and split it up into three parts. Christopher West Presents is part of that, which opens October 1st with a show by Danielle, who you'll be talking to in a second. The main gallery is going to remain Dean Johnson Gallery, but it's going to be more focused on contemporary design. Artists from the Indianapolis area and the Midwest coming in and doing kind of more object design-based work. And there's been such a crossover between the fine arts and design recently. We think those two are really going to play off of each other very well.
Now, the Dean Johnson Gallery is actually, it's on the first floor of their building on Mass Avenue that they've always used as sort of a not-for-profit gallery as a way to kind of promote their design business, which is a very cool thing. And the space that you're talking about, if people are familiar with the Dean Johnson Gallery, it's sort of the far end of the gallery, the last gallery box space you walk into when you go to an exhibit there. So the show, you'll have actually shows running concurrently with Scott Johnson's shows, right?
Exactly, exactly. And we're going to continue to do, and Christopher West Presents, probably on a monthly basis, we'll have new shows, probably 10 to 12 shows, focusing primarily on solo exhibitions and individual artist projects.
What's your vision for it as far as what type of work do you want to feature in Chris West Presents? Is it going to be, I mean, certainly contemporary, local?
It's going to be a mix of local, national, and international artists. Obviously, we're starting out with Danielle, who we're fortunate enough to have in Indy these days. The next show in November is a photographer from Los Angeles. And then got, you know, a mixture of artists planned throughout the next year, too, from all over.
Excellent. Well, it's really great to see you very quickly back on the scene again, curating work. It's always a pleasure to see a show that Chris West Presents. Now we get to see it at Chris West Presents.
It feels good. Very excited.
And for your first show, you've chosen Danielle Felice Reedy. Basically, you're taking sort of reclaimed things such as paint chips. I mean,
right.
The debris of other artists' work, if you will, that you're taking and reassembling, reconfiguring, reimagining in a site-specific space. Is that
That's
close?
Right. That's right. That's really close. Basically, I have been collecting paint and other artist materials for, I guess, I started doing this in about 2003, and I was interested in collecting the materials initially just from a textural and aesthetic point. I mean, the paint, I started out as a painter, and it can be so lush, and basically I ended up finding these fallen pieces of paint. It was kind of walking by a bridge in Charlottesville, Virginia. It was a bridge that had been spray painted over and over again, and the texture was so interesting to me that a friend of mine and I decided to make a project out of it, and then I've never gone back.
Sort of like peeling off the paint strips. You know, I find this really interesting because it seems like a lot of artists right now are using paint in a different way, even locally. An artist who I really enjoy we've had on the show is Mark Pack, who actually creates sort of sculptural pieces out of cutting through layers of acrylic paint. Here you are actually sort of reclaiming chips and pieces of discarded paint. It's fascinating to me, this sort of discovery of going beyond even the physicality of paint. I mean, that was sort of something that artists have explored in the past, but this is almost recycling of paint.
Right, it's recycling, so there's the sustainability issue, but which I'm really interested in. But beyond that, it's just, I think, something about reclaimed materials, what it is. It's almost like a scavenger hunt or a surprise for me. I end up finding patterns and textures that I wouldn't have come up with on my own, and so then I take those patterns and textures and reconfigure them into a new kind of drawn form in the space itself.
You actually
on the wall.
Assemble it right onto the wall.
Right onto the wall. Yes. So I'm really interested in the way the sculptural pieces react with the edges of the space, whether it be a hard line, a corner, sometimes trying to soften edges, working with the natural light of a space. Obviously, the pieces change throughout the day, so I try to see them at night and during the day, which is also kind of interesting to me as well. But, you know, there's so many beautiful materials that are being discarded that it seems like a shame
not to kind of partake mm-hmm. and make something out of them.
So this may seem a strange question, but maybe not within the context. Do you have, you're a professor at Heron, and obviously you're working with many students there, as well as you see the work of other faculty and other artists in town. Are there any painters who are sort of your favorites right now to collect their leftover scraps?
That's actually not a weird question at all. A lot of my friends know about my project, mm-hmm. and one of my favorite painters is Eric Saul. He's based out of New York, but sometimes I travel mm-hmm. to see him, and he always has these kind of cups of fabulous paint. He's actually, the interesting thing is we kind of influenced each other a little bit, because I've seen him scraping paint off of the painting, letting it dry, and then reincorporating it into the painting. So it's kind of a cyclical, kind of breathable interchange in between artists, and it's really beautiful to see develop. So,
Chris, let me ask you, what was it that that drew you to Daniel's work?
Well, we say these words like recycled, reclaimed. I hear those words, and I kind of think about that assemblage where you're just kind of taking mm-hmm. leftover materials. But what attracted me to Daniel's work was not that at all. It was just the pure beauty and simplicity of it. The first time I saw her work, the last words that entered my mind were recycled, you know, refurbished, rehashed. It was much more about just the simplicity and the beauty of the object and the super clean aesthetic. They're really, really wonderful.
A lot of times I actually don't even do much to the object that I find at all. I just kind of turn it around and see mm-hmm. the orientation and kind of fit it on the wall. So
almost
a lot of times it's just found and put right into the design.
Very cool. Sort of like a jigsaw puzzle without being predefined.
Exactly, exactly. And also I do make pieces. So, you know, I have this whole collection of colors and textures. But when I go into a space, I look at the space and kind of see whether or not I'd want more transparent pieces. I use resins to create things. So I'm making and finding.
Travis DiNicola with curator Chris West and Heron's assistant professor of painting, Danielle Felice Reedy. Reedy's work is featured in the Chris West Presents Gallery, located in the Dean Johnson Gallery on Mass Ave. The show opens Friday, October 2nd.
Thanks for joining us today. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Baselli Wallrap Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available through Owl Studios at owlstudios.com.
Please listen to The Art of the Matter again next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4.
I'll chat with Western author Larry Swayze and also find out about the new German Fest at the Athenaeum.
And Matt Sosi joins us for a special interview about Ball State's theater program.
And, of course, we'll be back with our regular calendar of events that we call
What'll We Do? So please listen next Friday at 8 and Saturday at 4 for The Art of the Matter here on WFYI for your information.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and Central Indiana. Your hosts are Sharon Gamble and Travis DiNicola. Today's Art of the Matter was produced and edited by Travis DiNicola. The Art of the Matter is made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and by grants from the Arts Council of Indianapolis and from the City of Indianapolis, and by support from the Central Indiana Community Foundation, the Indiana Arts Commission, a state agency, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, a federal agency. The Art of the Matter on 90.1 FM, Indianapolis.